Hello and welcome to the Zero to Finals podcast. My name is Tom, and in this new series on anesthetics, I'm going to start with an episode on general anesthesia. And you can find written notes on this topic at zerotofinals.com/general anesthesia or in the anesthetics and ICU section of the Zero to Finals surgery book. So let's get straight into it. There are two main categories of anesthesia. A general anesthesia, which involves making the patient unconscious, and a regional anesthesia, which involves blocking sensation to an isolated area of the body, for example, a limb. A general anesthetic involves putting the patient in a state of controlled unconsciousness. It's most often used so that a major surgical operation can be performed. During a general anesthetic, the patient will be intubated or have a supraglottic airway device, and their breathing will be supported and controlled by a ventilator. The patient will be continuously monitored at all times immediately before, during, and after a general anesthetic. Let's talk about fasting. Before a planned general anesthetic, the patient will have a period of fasting. The purpose of fasting is to make sure that they have an empty stomach to reduce the risk of the stomach contents refluxing into the oropharynx, or the throat, then being aspirated into the trachea, or the airway. Gastric contents in the lungs creates an aggressive inflammatory response causing pneumonitis, which is inflammation of the lung tissue. The risk of aspiration is highest before and during intubation, and when the patient is being extubated. Once the endotracheal tube is correctly fitted, the airway is blocked and protected from aspiration. Aspiration pneumonitis and pneumonia are major causes of morbidity or mortality in anesthetics, although with planned procedures, they're very rare. Fasting for an operation typically involves 6 hours of no food or feeds before the operation and 2 hours of no clear fluids, being fully nil by mouth. In emergency situations, the patient might not be fasted, and we're going to talk about rapid sequence intubation shortly. Let's talk about pre-oxygenation. Before being put under a general anesthetic, the patient will have a period of several minutes where they breathe 100% oxygen. This creates a reserve of oxygen for the period between when they lose consciousness and when they're successfully intubated and ventilated. This is in case the anaesthetist has difficulty establishing a secure airway. The pre-oxygenation step may need to be skipped when an emergency general anesthetic is required. Next, let's talk about pre-medication. Medications are given before the patient is put under a general anesthetic to relax them, reduce anxiety, reduce pain, and make intubation easier. And these may include benzodiazepines, for example, midazolam, to help relax the muscles and reduce anxiety. They also cause some amnesia, forgetting what's happened. Opiates, for example, fentanyl or alfentanil, to reduce pain and reduce the hypertensive response to the laryngoscope. And alpha-2 adrenergic agonists, for example, clonidine, which can help with sedation and pain. Next, let's talk about rapid sequence induction or rapid sequence intubation, which can be abbreviated to RSI. Rapid sequence induction or intubation is used to gain control over the airway as quickly and safely as possible where a patient is intubated in an emergency scenario and detailed pre-planning is not possible. This is considerably more risky compared with pre-planned intubation, as the patient has often not been fasted, so there's a risk of aspiration, and the anaesthetist has not had a chance to plan for individual factors and potential problems, for example, a difficult airway. It's also used in non-emergency situations where the airway needs to be secured quickly to avoid aspiration, such as in patients with gastroesophageal reflux or pregnancy. The procedure is designed to ensure successful intubation with an endotracheal tube as soon as possible after induction, which is when the patient is made unconscious, and this is in order to protect the airway. The biggest concern during rapid sequence induction or rapid sequence intubation is the aspiration of stomach contents into the lungs. The bed can be positioned so that the patient is more upright to reduce the risk of reflux of the contents up the esophagus. Cricoid pressure, which is pressing down on the cricoid cartilage in the neck, may be used to compress the esophagus and prevent the stomach contents from refluxing into the pharynx. Cricoid pressure is somewhat controversial and should only be done by somebody trained and experienced. There's an important triad of general anesthesia, and this triad involves hypnosis, muscle relaxation, and analgesia, and we'll cover each of these three things in turn. Let's start by talking about hypnosis. Hypnotic agents are used to make the patient unconscious. They can be given either intravenously or by inhalation. Intravenous options for a general anesthetic include propofol, which is the most commonly used, ketamine, thiopental sodium, which is less commonly used, and etomidate, which is rarely used. The inhaled options for a general anesthetic include sevoflurane, which is the most commonly used, desflurane, which is less favourable as it's bad for the environment, isoflurane, which is very rarely used, and nitrous oxide, which is combined with other anesthetic medications and may be used for gas induction in children. Sevoflurane, desflurane, and isoflurane are volatile anesthetic agents. Volatile agents are liquid at room temperature and need to be vaporized into a gas to be inhaled. Vaporizer devices are used for inhaled volatile agents. The liquid medication is poured into the machine. The machine then turns it into a vapor and mixes it with air in a controlled way. During the anesthesia, the concentration of the vaporized anesthetic medication can be altered to control the depth of the anesthesia. Commonly, an intravenous medication will be used as an induction agent to induce the unconsciousness, and inhaled medications will be used to maintain the general anesthetic during the operation. Inhaled medications need to diffuse across the lung tissue and into the blood, where it takes a while for them to reach an effective concentration. Intravenous agents have a head start as they're infused directly into the blood and can reach an effective concentration quicker. Total intravenous anesthesia, or TIVA, involves using an intravenous medication for induction and maintenance of the general anesthetic. Propofol is the most commonly used. This can give a nicer recovery as the patient wakes up compared with inhaled options. Next, let's talk about the second part of the triad of general anesthesia, which is muscle relaxation. Muscle relaxants block the neuromuscular junction from working. The neuromuscular junction is where the nervous system connects and sends signals to the muscles. Acetylcholine, which is a neurotransmitter, is released by the axon but is blocked from stimulating a response from the muscles. Muscle relaxants are given to relax and paralyze the muscles, which makes intubation and surgery a lot easier. There are two categories of muscle relaxants. Depolarizing, for example, succinylcholine, and non-depolarizing, for example, rocuronium and atricurium. Cholinesterase inhibitors, for example, neostigmine, can reverse the effects of neuromuscular blocking medications. Sugammadex is used specifically to reverse the effects of non-depolarizing muscle relaxants, such as rocuronium and vecuronium. Let's talk about the third part of the triad of general anesthesia, which is analgesia. Opiates are the most frequently used medication for analgesia, or pain relief. Common agents used in anesthetics are fentanyl, alfentanyl, remifentanyl, and morphine. Antiemetics, or anti-nausea and vomiting medications, are often given at the end of a procedure by an anesthetist to prevent post-operative nausea and vomiting. Common options for prophylaxis given at the end of an operation are ondansetron, which is a 5-HT3 receptor antagonist, However, ondansetron needs to be avoided in patients who are at risk of prolonged QT interval. Dexamethasone, which is a corticosteroid, which needs to be used with caution in diabetic or immunocompromised patients. Or cyclizine, which is a histamine H1 receptor antagonist, which needs to be used with caution in heart failure and elderly patients. Next, let's talk about emergence. Before waking the patient, the muscle relaxant needs to have worn off. It's not good for the patient to regain consciousness while still paralyzed, and this is referred to as awareness under anesthesia. A nerve stimulator can be used to test the muscle responses to stimulation to ensure the muscle relaxant effects have ended. This is often tested on the ulnar nerve in the wrist, watching for thumb movement, specifically twitches of the thumb. Alternatively, the facial nerve can be stimulated at the temple while watching for movement in the orbicularis oculi muscle at the eye. This involves what's called a train of four stimulation, where the nerve is stimulated four times to see if the muscle responses remain strong, indicating that the muscle relaxant has worn off, or whether the muscle responses get weaker with additional stimulation, indicating the muscle relaxant has not fully worn off. Medication can be used to reverse the effects of the muscle relaxants if required, as we've discussed above, for example, Sagamidex. Once the muscle relaxant has worn off, the inhaled anesthetic is stopped. The concentration of the anesthetic in the body will fall and the patient will regain consciousness. Patients are extubated at the point where they're breathing for themselves. Next, let's talk about the risks of a general anesthetic. Sore throat and post-operative nausea and vomiting are common adverse effects of a general anesthesia. Significant risks of a general anesthesia include accidental awareness, waking up during the anesthetic, aspiration of the stomach contents into the lungs, dental injury, mainly when the laryngoscope is used for intubation, anaphylaxis, cardiovascular events, for example, a myocardial infarction, stroke, or arrhythmia, malignant hypothermia, which is rare but we'll talk about in more detail shortly, and death. Finally, let's talk about malignant hypothermia. Malignant hypothermia is a rare but potentially fatal hypermetabolic response to anesthesia. The risk is mainly with volatile anesthetics, for example, isoflurane, sevoflurane, and desflurane, and with succinylmethonium. There are genetic mutations that increase the risk of malignant hypothermia, and these are inherited in an autosomal dominant pattern. Malignant hypothermia causes an increased body temperature, or hypothermia, increased carbon dioxide exhalation, tachycardia, or a fast heart rate, muscle rigidity, acidosis, and hyperkalemia, or a raised potassium. Malignant hypothermia is treated with dantrolene. Dantrolene is a muscle relaxant that works by interfering with the movement of calcium ions in skeletal muscle. So thanks for listening to this episode on general anesthesia. As always, a big thank you to Harry Watchman for perfectly editing these podcasts. And I hope you join us for the next episode where we'll talk about other types of anesthesia.